rather than to proceed with total war. This might mean devising and instituting a much more ambitious scheme of anti-surprise attack measures than had been politically feasible during the earlier period. It would mean negotiating not just under the ordinary pressure of knowing that sneak attack is a long-term danger, but doing it with clear notice that if measures to make successful first strike impossible have not been devised, agreed upon, and taken by a quick deadline, war by mutual consent has become inevitable. These reflections do not imply that extra warning would be either useless or embarrassing. What they indicate is that warning by itself may not be enough. Extra warning provides an opportunity, but the opportunity has to be exploited with skill, and preparations for what one would do in the contingency may have to be made well ahead of time. There is barely time to deliver an ultimatum to the Russians when we catch them preparing to attack. Deciding what ultimatum would both meet our needs and be tolerable to the Russians is not only intellectually difficult, it is technically difficult, depending on such things as procedures to verify compliance. We could probably deliver an effective ultimatum only if we had planned carefully ahead of time on what it might contain. There are two quite distinct criteria for judging the efficacy of an inspection system, or for designing the system itself. One is how well the system gets at the truth in spite of efforts to conceal it. The other is how well it helps one to reveal the truth convincingly when it is in his interest to do so. The difference is like that between a scheme for discovering the guilty and a scheme for permitting the innocent to establish innocence. Roughly speaking, one system arrives at a presumption of innocence in a negative way, by an absence of positive evidence to the contrary. The other scheme relies on positive evidence and is pertinent to the particular situations in which one's own interest is in letting the truth be known. The difference between these two situations is pertinent to the distinction between a scheme to minimize the fear of deliberate surprise attack and a scheme to minimize the fear of inadvertent or accidental or unintended war. The war that results from a false alarm, or from a mistaken evaluation of the other's response to a false alarm, or to a wrong interpretation of a mechanical accident, or to the catalytic mischief of a third party interested in promoting war, or to a situation in which the apprehension by each side that the other may be about to preempt explodes by feedback into a war by mutual panic. In the case of a planned, deliberate surprise attack, the aggressor has every reason to disguise the truth. But in the case of inadvertent war, both sides have a strong interest in conveying the truth if the truth can in fact be conveyed in a believable way in time to prevent the other side's mistaken decision. Misapprehension of attack. Consider this question. How would we prove to the Soviet Union that we were not engaged in a surprise attack when in fact we were not, but they thought we might be? How might they prove to us that they were not initiating a surprise attack if in fact they were not, but they knew that we were afraid they might be? Evidently, it is not going to be enough just to tell the truth. There may indeed be some situations in which sheer verbal contact is enough to allay each side's suspicions. If the Russians, just to take a wild example, suffered an accidental nuclear explosion on one of their own bases, it might be helpful to both sides if they could simply reassure us quickly that they knew it was an accident, that they were not interpreting it as a harbinger of an attack by us, and so on. But in most of the cases that one can imagine, it is insufficient simply to assert that one is not engaging in a strategic strike, or that one is not in a menacing posture. There has to be some way of authenticating certain facts, the facts presumably involving the disposition of forces. We would have to prove not only that we were not intending to exploit our position, but that our actual position was one that could not be exploited to double-cross the enemy if he should take us at our word and restrain his own forces. Misapprehension during limited war. Especially in the course of a limited war, one side or the other may take an action that might be misinterpreted as a strategic strike. Suppose, for example, that we used the kinds of aircraft that would alternatively be used in a strike against Russian bases, and flew them in directions that might be interpreted as aimed at the Soviet Union itself, as might be the case if they were flying from North African bases or the Mediterranean fleet to countries near the southern border of the Soviet Union. Alternatively, suppose that the Soviet aircraft flew a limited war mission that could be interpreted on the basis of the momentary evidence we might get as a strike at all of our overseas bases and carriers, but that was actually a limited strike and not part of a general effort to destroy United States retaliatory power. The question arises whether there are any means by which to reduce the likelihood of misinterpretation in this case, where misinterpretation might lead one side either to take off in anticipated retaliation, to preempt as quickly as it could, or to get into a super alert status that had a high proclivity toward false alarm. One might wish to bend over backwards to demonstrate that complementary actions, actions involving other forces in other parts of the world, that would almost certainly take place if this were an all-out counterforce strike, were in fact not being taken. Reciprocal misapprehension. Consider another case that was described by Gromyko at a press conference. After all, meteors and electronic interference are reflected on Soviet radar screens, too. If in such cases Soviet aircraft loaded with atomic and hydrogen bombs were to proceed in the direction of the United States and its bases in other states, the air fleets of both sides having noticed each other somewhere over the Arctic region, under such circumstances would draw the natural conclusion that a real attack by the enemy was taking place, and mankind would find itself involved in the whirlpool of atomic war. Assuming for the moment that a situation like that described might conceivably arise, how might the interacting misapprehensions of both sides be slowed down and reversed? If there were some way of reversing motion on both sides in a properly phased and authenticated way, a kind of balanced withdrawal by mutual consent might be possible. The bargaining environment is not a propitious one. At best, there would be only hours in which to conduct the negotiations, and at worst, no time at all. The requirements for a successful outcome can analytically be divided into two parts. First, there has to be discovered some solution, some pattern of action that reverses the trend toward mutual attack, and that constitutes a dynamically stable withdrawal to a less menacing alert status, one that yields neither side a dangerous advantage in the process, and that is within the physical capabilities of the forces concerned. The second requirement is that compliance somehow be observable, verifiable, and provable. We cannot carry out our part of the bargain unless we have trustworthy means for monitoring the other side's compliance, and the same is true for them. Conceivably, we would have an interest in cheating, but it is overwhelmingly more probable that we should wish in these circumstances for a cheat-proof monitoring system that we could submit to, so that if we did comply with our part of the bargain, the other side would have no doubt about it. The problem is essentially one of contract enforcement, and the motivation in this case for each side is to convey the truth as best it can, if in fact it complies with the plan. This example not only makes clear the need for some prior arrangement for observation and verification in view of the very short time available for bringing inspectors to the scene, it also demonstrates how important it is to have thought ahead of time about what kind of proposal to make, and to have designed one's own flight plan in a way that could take maximum advantage of any means we might have for deliberately giving the enemy true information in the event it becomes desperately necessary to do so. This case also may illustrate the difference between the two criteria for reliability of an inspection system. It might be very difficult to design radar that would always catch the enemy, and by which he could always catch us, in an attempt at sneak attack. It is quite another question how to design radar so that if we both wished to invite voluntary surveillance, we could submit in a convincing way. In one case, we are, in effect, evading his radar surveillance as best we can. In the other way, we may deliberately parade in front of his radar, or submit to other means of long-distance recognition as long as he does the same for us. Longer-term surveillance. The difference between these crises and emergency situations and the longer-term problems of policing arms limitations is in the kind of evidence that is required and in the strength of the motivation to provide it. The more leisurely process of inspection is generally viewed as depending mainly on negative evidence, that is, the absence of evidence. One reduces the probability of missing such evidence by enlarging and intensifying the system, and one supposes that the evasion is made difficult by the need to keep activities hidden over a long period. But in a crisis, one requires more certain evidence. One does not have time to get leads and follow them up. There is no time to try the system out and enlarge it or intensify it if it does not work. Consequently, a crisis agreement would have to rely on positive evidence. Instead of looking for evidence about what the other party is not doing, one demands evidence that shows what he is doing. And the reason why such evidence might be forthcoming in a crisis is that the motive to provide it, the greater urgency of reaching an understanding or an agreement that depends on it, may be enhanced in such an emergency. Overbuilding the system. For the purpose of being at least somewhat prepared for crises and unforeseen situations, there is a good argument for instituting some flexible standby arrangements for communicating with potential enemies and inspecting each other. In particular, there is a good argument for overbuilding an inspection system relative to such use as has been agreed on. Having standby capacity to enlarge or intensify the system, or to augment it with additional facilities and inspectors, may have a good deal to do with the usefulness of the system in time of crisis. To put the point differently, we should not judge the reliability and usefulness of a system solely in terms of the motivations of the participants during normal operations. We should recognize that occasions may arise when there is a powerful motive for crash negotiations on arms limitations, at least momentary limitations, with no time available for setting up observation and communication systems ad hoc. To be specific, in the event there should be established an inspection system to monitor an agreement to suspend nuclear tests, we should consider carefully how both sides might take advantage of the inspectors and their facilities in the event of an acute military crisis. The mobility of the inspectors, their location, their communication facilities, their technical training and surveillance equipment, their trustworthiness, and their numbers should be evaluated and designed not just with nuclear test detection in mind, but with some view to their serving a desperately critical need for a means of inspection, verification, and communication in a crisis that threatens both us and the Russians with inadvertent war. From the foregoing considerations, it is not at all clear that the stability of the balance of terror, the lack of temptation to deliberate surprise attack, and the immunity of the situation to false alarm will be greatly affected by the military arrangements that we try to work out with the Russians. As nature reveals her scientific and technological secrets over the coming years, we may find that each side, if it does what it ought to do and does it rapidly enough, can substantially assure the invulnerability of its own retaliatory forces irrespective of what the other side does, and assure it in a convincing way so that a powerfully stable mutual deterrence results. Alternatively, nature may have planted mischievous secrets ahead of us so that we and the Russians continually find new ways to destroy retaliatory forces at a faster rate than we find new ways to protect them. There is only a hope, no presumption, that even with great ingenuity and the best of diplomacy, we and the Russians could find cooperative measures to arrest a trend toward instability. So we may get stability without cooperation, or we may not find it even with cooperation. Still, some kind of cooperation with the Russians, or mutual restraint, formal or informal, tacit or explicit, may prove to make a significant difference in the stability of the balance of terror, and the stakes, of course, are very high. So although we cannot be sure that a deliberate policy of collaborating to make each side's retaliatory forces invulnerable would make any difference, we have to consider that it might, and to ask ourselves whether in fact we should want a perfectly stable balance of deterrence if we had the option before us. Would we really be interested in a far-reaching and effective anti-surprise attack scheme if we knew of one, and if we thought the Russians would accept it? Although it would be comforting to know that the Russians could not be tempted into a deliberate planned sneak attack, and comforting to know that they were so sure we wouldn't try it that they would never need to jump the gun in panic, it can nevertheless be argued that our ability to deter anything but a major assault on ourselves depends, at least somewhat, on the Russian belief that we might be goaded into deliberate attack. The Russians might not believe this if their retaliatory forces were substantially invulnerable to a first strike by ours. It can be argued that, except under the most extreme provocation, we would shrink from any retaliatory strike that had no significant chance of eliminating or softening the Russian return strike. According to this argument, a pair of invulnerable sacks is a pair of neutralized sacks. And while that might be the best kind in a completely bipolar world, it is a luxury that we could not afford in the existing world. A world in which there is a large third area in which we wish to deter Russian aggression by a threat more credible than that of mutual suicide. Can we threaten to retaliate, not just to resist locally, if the Russians unquestionably possess the military capacity to return us a blow of any size they please? Have the strategic forces any role when each is invulnerable to the other, except to neutralize each other and to guarantee, by their joint existence, their joint disuse? There is a role. Strategic forces would still be capable of carrying out retaliation in the punitive sense, if the threat of knocking out Russian or Chinese cities was originally thought to be potent because of the sheer pain, economic loss, disorganization, and humiliation that would be involved, and not mainly because the military posture of the enemy in the immediate area of his aggression would be greatly affected. The main ingredient of the threat would still be present, even if the other side's sack were invulnerable. The threat of massive retaliation, if massive is interpreted to mean unlimited retaliation, does indeed lose credibility with the loss of our hope that a skillfully conducted all-out strike might succeed in precluding counter-retaliation. But if we were ever to consider limited or graduated reprisals as a means of putting pressure on the Russians to desist from actions intolerable to us, or to consider extending a limited local war inside Russian borders in a way that maintained the pretense of local military action but was really intended to work through the sanction of civilian pain and the threat of more, this kind of retaliatory action, and the threat of it, might enjoy increased credibility with a reduction in the vulnerability of both sides' strategic forces. It does, paradoxically, for the same reason that all kinds of limited war might become less inhibited as the possibility of all-out surprise attack became unavailable. The risk involved in a bit of less-than-massive retaliation should be less than it is now because the fear of an all-out strike in return should be a good deal less. The fear that our limited retaliation would be mistaken for the first step in the initiation of all-out war should be less. The Russians would have to believe that we were literally prepared for suicide to mistake our limited retaliation for the initial step in mutual obliteration. This is not to argue that limited retaliation entailing the risk, if not the certainty, of limited counter-retaliation cannot lead to total destruction, either slowly or by explosion into greater and greater retaliatory strikes, or would not be frightful to contemplate even if kept limited. The problem of limiting a war of reprisal may be no easier than that of limiting local war, and it may be harder. The argument here, however, does not depend on making an exchange of limited punitive blows appear safe and attractive compared with limited local war, but safe enough and attractive enough compared with all-out war to be a credible threat, and not a called bluff, in any case where we may have to rely on the threat of retaliation. The strategic forces would thus be neutralized only in respect of potential attacks on each other. They would still possess a punitive role that provides some basis for a deterrent threat. While the threat of all-out punishment may lose credibility with the achievement of invulnerability by both sides' retaliatory forces, the threat of limited retaliation may well gain it. Whatever the net effect, we cannot deprecate a world of invulnerable sacks simply by reference to the need for third-area deterrence. It has to be demonstrated that one particular deterrent threat, the massive one, is more potent than the other, limited one. Only an extreme optimist can think that we may ever have a clear choice of accepting or rejecting a scheme that would guarantee to make both sides' retaliatory forces totally and continuously invulnerable. But this question of what would happen to third-area deterrence and the limited retaliation possibility that it calls to mind are pertinent to the question of what we might let ourselves hope for. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Strategy of Conflict, written by Thomas C. Schelling, performed by Brian Holsapple. Executive producers Rena Seth and Mike Charzuk. Producer Kat Lambrix. Copyright 1960 and 1980 by the President and Fellows of Harvard College. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.